We're going to look at those verses we just read, Acts 16, verse 6 through to 40. Now, the history of this world has been, I suppose you can describe it in different ways, but really, essentially, the history of this world has been the history of the rise and fall of empires. Wherever you look in the world, whether it's in China or India or Rome or Greece, wherever it is, there have been empires, and those empires have risen, and those empires have fallen as well. Now, historians have written all sorts of books on this, talking about, well, what is it that makes an empire rise, and then what is it that means it eventually falls at the end as well? And for God's people, that's an important subject to think about as well, because we believe in God's kingdom, and we want it to grow. So we want to know, well, how does that actually happen? And the verses we read in Acts 16 are going to help us answer that question. We're not, as I said, we're not going to actually study the book of Philippians tonight, but we're going to set the scene. Because it's important to remember, and I say this of Philippians, but it's true of every book of the Bible, that it's, you know, Philippians isn't just a generic letter written from a generic person to another generic group of people. There are particular circumstances involved here. So that's why we can't go straight to Philippians itself. Acts 16 records Paul and Silas travelling to Philippi and the early beginnings of the church there. And it's going to be another 10 years until Paul actually writes the letter of Philippians. 10 years between these events and that letter. But in the meantime, there's a lot we can learn tonight from Acts 16 about Philippi. And we'll start in Acts 16, verse 12, where you've got Paul and Silas. And I said earlier as well, almost certainly Luke. And the reason I believe, and people generally believe it's Luke, is that it changes to talking. If you look in verse 10, it says, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia. It changes from they to we. And that's almost certainly because Luke must have joined them. So now Luke, who's the author of Acts, is including himself in the story we now carried on. So what does Luke want us to know about Philippi? Well, here's what the one thing he describes it as in verse 12, when he talks about Philippi, he tells us it's a colony. It's a Roman colony. It had been established as a Roman colony about 100 years earlier by Caesar Augustus. And it was a place where Roman army veterans, when they retired, they'd often go and retire in Philippi. They'd be given a parcel of land, they'd set up their home. So full of retired Roman army folk living in Philippi. But also because it was a Roman colony, it functioned as a mini Rome. So the citizens there all enjoyed the rights of being Roman citizens. They all spoke Latin. They dressed like Romans dressed. Their coins had Latin inscriptions on them. They thought of themselves as Romans. I don't know if you noticed, when they go in verses 20 and 21, they go and complain about what Paul and Silas have been doing. What they say is, they teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans. They see themselves, even though they live many hundreds of miles away, they see themselves as Romans. Now, Philippi had been a Roman colony for about 100 years. And that meant they'd observed firsthand, the people who lived there, how the Roman Empire grew. And if you know anything of the history of the Roman Empire, you know it, that emperor after emperor grew and sustained the kingdom and their own rule in a completely despotic manner. Caesar Augustus, for example, he slaughtered his way to power. He murdered every prominent opponent that stood in his path. He had a reputation for excessive cruelty. It was Caesar Augustus who, he had a standard response. It became well known, famous, that he had a standard wording. He would say to people as they begged him for mercy, begged him to save their lives, he would just say, "You must die." Well known, Caesar Augustus. And it wasn't just him. Roman emperors were like that. Nero murdered his own mother, his brother, his wife, and his aunt, and he had killed countless others people. Every Caesar was like that. That's how the Roman Empire grew and sustained itself. That's how each emperor stayed in power and maintained the Roman borders. Now in Philippi, it had even a longer history of that sort of rule, because it was very close by to Philippi that Alexander the Great had been born and raised up to rule over the enormous Greek Empire. And Alexander the Great, I could give you similar sorts of descriptions of him. He ruled by savagery and shows of strength. So both Alexander and every Roman emperor proved the same thing. They showed the same message again and again. Kingdoms grow by force, by brutality, by an iron fist that stamps down on your opponents. That's why the events of this chapter happening in Philippi are so startling and so opposed to that way of growing. Because the church here grows in a completely opposite way to everything I've just described. And in fact, every show of brutality and strength that people try to muster up just seems to make things worse for themselves. Now, Paul and Silas coming to Philippi, let's mention this as well, is very symbolically significant. Because this is the first time they've set foot on European soil. So far, their mission has gone from Israel, they've spread out, they've spread the gospel, they've visited various places in Turkey, for example. But now the church is starting to expand into a new continent. So the key question is, well, how is that going to happen? How will the church grow there? Well, against that background of a brutal, powerful, bloodthirsty regime that the citizens in Philippi are a part of, the church will grow in Europe as God's people are obedient and as God's Spirit works. That's what I want you to notice from this chapter. If you were here this morning, you'd probably notice some similarities. And I didn't actually plan it that way, but actually there is a huge amount to say here. You notice in these verses the interplay between God's sovereignty in opening and closing not just doors, but prison cells and hearts and minds. And you also see God's people stepping out in costly obedience. So let's go back to verse 9 then. Verse 9, Paul receives this vision where a man from Macedonia pleads with him and says, come over to Macedonia and help us. And Philippi is in Macedonia, if you're wondering what the connection with that is. So in verse 10, they immediately get up and go. Notice that God doesn't explain his plans to Paul. He doesn't say what he's going to be doing over there in Macedonia, in Philippi. He's told to go, and he goes. That's important because the same is true for us, that we are called to obey, but we're not always called to understand. But that's not because God's making things difficult for us. Actually, I suspect it would have been much, much harder for Paul if God had told him what would happen there in Philippi. If God had said to him, look, I want you to get up and I want you to go there because when you're there, yes, you'll meet a rich woman who's going to be saved, but then there's going to be this demon-possessed woman and day after day that this girl is going to annoy you and shout things in your ear. And then after that, actually, you're going to be beaten to within an inch of your life and you're going to be thrown into prison and you're not going to know whether you're going to live or die. Actually, it would have been much harder for Paul to obey that than a simple command to get up and go to Macedonia. Sometimes we think, if only God would tell me the future, wouldn't that be a kind thing? Actually, no. It's an act of God's mercy and kindness towards us when he doesn't tell us the future. And it's a calling for us to obey even when we don't understand. But Paul and Silas obey. And what you notice is when they obey, things happen. So verse 13, they go out to the riverside, the place of prayer. It seems there was no synagogue there. And the reason for that almost certainly would have been that they didn't have enough. You needed 10 Jewish men to form a synagogue, and it looks like there were very few, if any, at all Jewish men. It's just an informal gathering of God-fearing women meeting to pray there. But they meet Lydia in verse 14. She's a seller of purple, and that means she must have been quite wealthy to be dealing with the material that royals would be buying and wearing. So this is a wealthy female business entrepreneur. She's there praying. We read that the Lord opens up her heart. She and her household, so presumably not just children, but servants, staff as well, are saved, baptized. So Paul and Silas obey, and things happen. The Lord opens hearts. Then you carry on into verse 16. I like how it starts there, now it happened. Almost as if, now just by coincidence, but it's not a coincidence what happens here. It's not just by chance, but what happens is this slave girl is there. As Paul and Silas are being obedient and faithful, again, things happen. This slave girl goes there, and day after day she's shouting help, shouting in their ears, until you get to a point where in verse 18, Paul gets frustrated. He gets annoyed. Now maybe he gets annoyed because he doesn't want her distracting from the message he's trying to preach. Maybe he doesn't want to be associated with her. He doesn't want people thinking that she's a part of his crew. Maybe it's more basic than that. If you ever had a long car journey with children, you know what it's like to having people shout in your ear for an hour after. It's not fun sometimes. Maybe he just got annoyed because she'd been shouting day after day, as he just tried to walk along the street and do normal things. When God's power is able to speak and command this evil spirit to come out. And this young girl is remarkably changed. So much so that her owners know they've got no hope of ever using her to gain a profit again. I suspect, although it doesn't actually say it, I suspect she's saved and she's added to the church. This slave girl is now a part of this young church in Philippi. And Paul and Silas act out of obedience and things happen. And then thirdly, we've got this encounter in prison. It's back in verse 19, they're dragged in front of the authorities. In verse 22, they're stripped naked, their clothes are torn off them, they're beaten with rods, they're thrown into prison with their feet in stocks. How do they respond? Verse 22, there they are, at midnight, the sun's set, it's probably very dark, not able to stand up, stretch their legs. No idea what's going to happen to them in the morning, but they're singing hymns to God. I don't know whether they felt like it or not. I don't know what emotions were running through their mind or not. But at very least, this is an act of obedience, an act of declaring their trust in God while they're in prison. Sometimes we sing because we want to, don't we? You know, like when a great song comes on the radio and you just want to start singing along or even dancing. Sometimes that's how we feel, and we sing that way. But sometimes we sing simply as a way of saying, I am going to trust in God. In the midst of my suffering and my confusion and my sadness, Paul and Silas are responding here in faith. They're obeying the command to sing, to rejoice, to make a joyful noise to the Lord. And as they obey, things happen. God acts. An earthquake comes, and the director of the prison runs out to them, falls down in front of them, and cries out, "What must I do to be saved?" What have Paul and Silas done here? They've responded to a trial by singing. That's it. They've not conjured up any secret powers. They've not preached an amazing sermon. They've been faithful, and they've trusted in their God, and that's it. And now they see God working in this jailer's heart, and his eyes are opened, and he and his household believe. They're saved. We're thinking this morning a bit about 2019. What do we focus on as a church in 2019? There are lots of good answers to that question. We could make a long list. We certainly need to be a praying church. Churches need to focus on praying. We certainly need to be a gospel preaching church. We need to focus on preaching, on proclaiming Christ. But we also need to be an obedient church, to be obedient people. A church that takes God's word seriously and obeys it. Because what's coming out of this passage, what you see with Paul and Silas, is when God's people obey, things happen. For Paul and Silas, that meant leaving Asia, heading into unknown territory, being harangued by a slave girl, wound up day after day. It meant facing opposition from people, being brought to stand in front of magistrates, standing trial for things they hadn't done, being beaten with rods, the type of rods that were designed to tear flesh from the body, going into a dark prison with real criminals facing an unknown future. That's what their obedience meant for them. For Paul and Silas, the personal cost of gospel success was tremendous. We read at the end of our passage in verses 35 through to 40 how they were freed from prison. The magistrates realise that they're Roman citizens and they're terrified and they bring them out and they say, "Go on, leave the city." But you know, I can't imagine that would have looked like a triumphant, victorious exit from the city of Philippi. I expect after that type of beating they'd received, that they hobbled and limped away, still black and blue, bruised, aching. Because the sort of beatings people got in those days, it would make front page news today. This is the sort of thing that scars someone for life. The sort of thing that makes you wake up 10 years later in the middle of the night, screaming because you're having a dream that it's happening again. You're back there being beaten, thinking you're going to die. People died from these beatings. Now, the Philippian church saw that. And I hope you can see why this is important when you come to read the letter of Philippians. Paul writes about this in Philippians 1, verse 29. He says, "It to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake." And here it is, "having the same conflict which you saw in me, and now here is in me." They saw Paul's experience. They saw what happened to him physically. They saw the bruises. They saw the tears in his flesh from this beating. And 10 years later, as Paul's writing that letter to Philippians, he's saying, "You're now following that same path. You'll have the same scars as me one day." Do you know, sometimes obedience leaves scars. Scars that can even last a lifetime. Maybe you carry scars like that. The scars of obedience. You feel the pain and you can testify, yes, following Christ costs something. The pain is real. And maybe it's something that happened years ago, but you can still see and feel the pain and the cost of that. Take comfort from these words, from these events in Philippi. Because good always comes from those things. You know, the suffering of Paul and Silas here is what opens doors for the gospel that would otherwise surely have remained shut. How else would that church have been established there? If they hadn't been willing to go to Macedonia, how else would they have been able to reach that Philippian jailer and his household? If they hadn't ended up in prison following that beating. Costly obedience is so often what God uses not only to bless his children, but to grow his church and to bring glory to his Son. Because when God's people obey him, put him first, things happen. Here's one quote from a writer I find helpful on this. He says this, "God will not send trial without the intention of blessing. Therefore, when the trial is great, we may be sure that the blessing intended is great also. Maybe for you it's a slightly different situation. Maybe even now you feel like you're at a crossroads and you know the path of obedience is going to hurt. You know there are ways in which he's calling you to follow him, but you're still perhaps resisting because you know it's going to be painful. Maybe there are relationships you have where you think, things just aren't right here. I need to do something. I need to apologise to that person, but it's going to hurt. I need to change how I speak to that person. Maybe there are relationships where you think, I need to do something, but you know that the cost of obedience is high. Maybe there are things in your finances. You think, I know I need to change. I know how Jesus is calling me to obey here. Keep putting it off because it's going to hurt. Maybe there are temptations, and the pleasure of those temptations when you give in is great. And you enjoy that pleasure. It might only be fleeting, but you enjoy it. And you know you need to stop giving in to them. But the cost of obedience, it just feels so high. You know it's going to hurt. God calls us to follow, even in those instances, sharing in the fellowship of his suffering, of the suffering of his son. There's a missionary to India called Amy Carmichael. She wrote a poem about her scars. It's called Hast Thou No Scar? And in it she talks about her scars in really, really poetic language. She describes how she feels she's been wounded by the archers, like, as if arrows have come and burst into her flesh and it's caused her pain. She talks about how she's been pushed to the point of death, surrounded by ravenous beasts. And in the final verse of her poem, she asks the reader, I think it's a very challenging question. She says, no wound, no scar, yet as the master, the servant shall be. And pierced are the feet that follow me, but thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound nor scar? You see her point. As the master, the servant shall be. That's what you find in Paul's life here. Often in Paul, as you trace Paul and the things that happen to him throughout, his life often parallels the life of Jesus Christ. You see that in all sorts of ways. And you find it again here. You find it particularly in verses 20 through to 23, where Paul's charged of causing trouble and teaching things that aren't lawful for them as Romans. His charge against him isn't true. He's not been causing trouble. He's not been teaching things that aren't lawful for them. It's a lie. And actually, the real reason these people are angry is because of this slave girl who they're not going to be able to benefit from financially anymore. Paul stands and faces false accusations. I hope that's ringing bells for you. Very similar to Jesus, Luke 23, verse 2, the charge the Jewish leaders bring to Pilate against Jesus is this: we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. It's just not true, is it? Jesus didn't forbid paying taxes to Caesar. It's a lie. They're making these things up out of envy to Jesus. You see how Paul's life is mirroring the life of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus' life, more than any other life, is characterized by obedience to God the Father. Jesus endures false accusations, beatings, mock trials. But as Jesus obeyed and submitted to his Father's will, things happened. God worked. The lame walked. The blind could see, that lepers were healed, the dead were raised to life, because the accusations couldn't stick, the beatings couldn't destroy him, the grave couldn't hold him down, because God was at work. As Jesus obeyed the will of his Father, things happened. God says to us, this is my way, It is the way of the cross. The life of every Christian will mirror the life of Jesus Christ insofar as we follow him. And the book of Philippians teaches us that. It's one of the things that comes out again and again in Philippians. It's in Philippians that Paul will return to the big themes that he lived out, he experienced. He's not just writing those things from a distance as he writes the book of Philippians. He's experienced that suffering, the suffering of following Christ. He's going to remind us in Philippians, as we read through that letter, God willing, starting next Sunday, he's going to remind us that the way God's kingdom grows isn't the way the Roman Empire grows. It's not by force. It's not by dominance. It's not by brutality. Instead, God says, not by might, nor by power, but by my Spirit. God's kingdom grows as God himself works, and as his people obey and follow him. He's going to remind them in Philippians 2 that they're to have the mind of Christ, doing nothing out of selfish ambition, putting others first, just as Christ did for us. He's going to remind them in Philippians 3 that Christians experience the fellowship of Jesus' sufferings. And those are reminders that our church in Philippi are going to need. Because think about who's in that church, that fledgling young baby church. You've got a jailer who messed up and was fearful for his life, who's going to be sacked for what happened. You've got a slave girl who used to go around the street shouting at people, rounding them up. And you've got Lydia, a businesswoman, a foreigner from Thyatira, from Turkey. You know, not even a local. That is not your ideal church plan. If you were lining up your candidates to launch the attack on Europe, they are not the people you choose. But that doesn't matter. What matters is, will those believers in that fledgling church obey? Because when God's people obey and follow Christ, things happen. God works. And there's one final theme to bring from this book of Philippians. It's something we will be touching on at various points as we go through that letter, but it's important to bring it into the mix tonight as well. I said earlier that when Paul and Silas were in prison, they were singing hymns, but we don't really know what their frame of mind is. It doesn't tell us that, but they were certainly singing out of obedience. They were singing, if nothing more, they were singing out of obedience. But actually, I suspect they were singing for joy as well. And the reason I suspect that is because when Paul wrote the book of Philippians, he was in prison again. 10 years have passed, and he finds himself imprisoned once more, this time in Rome, awaiting standing trial before Caesar, and Caesar is going to determine whether Paul lives or dies. He talks in Philippians 1 verse 13 about his chains, and he's literally referring to chains. It seems like nothing's moved on in his life. 10 years later, he finds himself in chains again. How does he respond as he writes Philippians? 16 times, he talks about joy in that book. Joy. He says he rejoices when he thinks about the believers in that church. And it's these believers we've just read about. He says he rejoices that his chains have furthered the cause of the gospel among the prison guard. He rejoices when he thinks about other people preaching the gospel. He says he rejoices in the Lord. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. How can Paul say that in prison? Back there again? Going through the same sort of pain again? It's that old Sunday school song that has that wonderful simplicity about it. With Christ in the vessel, we can smile at the storm. I think nowadays it's with Jesus in the boat. But I learned it, with Christ in the vessel, we can smile at the storm. It's actually Jesus did that himself. It's Hebrews 12 verse 2. Jesus says, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. So as we obey, as it costs, as at times it may even scar us and leave wounds that take time to heal, like Paul, we can rejoice. That's what we're going to see again and again in the book of Philippians. Because with Christ in the vessel, we can smile at the storm. And because when we obey, things happen. God works. And I want to see God work more and more. That's what we want, isn't it? I'm not saying God's like a slot machine where you put in the obedience and the stuff comes back out. But I am saying there is a pattern there that we do well to acknowledge. We obey because Christ is glorified. And we obey because so often when we do so, God works. Well, let's close our service by singing. It's hymn number 822. Jesus calls us o'er the tumult of our life's wild, restless sea. This is a hymn that calls us to follow Jesus in spite of the pain, in spite of our fears, to give him our hearts, to give him our obedience. So we'll close our service by singing 822.